Welcome back to History's Burn Book, the podcast where we examine humanity's greatest achievements and then immediately ask, okay, but what was the drama? Now, last time the American colonies had defeated Britain, the Revolutionary War ended, the Treaty of Paris was signed, George Washington stunned the world by voluntarily giving up his power. Everyone celebrated. Fireworks, parades, patriotic speeches, victory, freedom, a bright new future. But ultimately, nobody had paid much attention to the one small detail. How exactly was this new country supposed to function? As it turns out, overthrowing a government and building a government require very different skill sets. One involves muskets, the other involves paperwork. And we know history consistently underestimates how much paperwork is involved. So today we arrive at one of the greatest political experiments ever attempted. The creation of the United States Constitution, or as History's Burn Book prefers to call it, the summer 55 men argued about absolutely everything. Yeah, fun. Let's begin. So now technically, America already had a government, sort of, okay? The new nation operated under something called the Articles of Confederation. And the Articles had one major goal, to never create another king. Founders had just spent years fighting King George III. The last thing they wanted was a powerful central government. So they designed a system where most authority remained within the states. Congress existed, but its powers were extremely limited. They could request money. States could ignore that request. Congress could ask for soldiers. States could ignore that request. Congress could make recommendations. States could ignore those too. A pattern was developing. Imagine trying to run a company where every department can simply say no thanks. That was the Articles of Confederation. The national government had responsibility, but very little authority. At first, many Americans thought this was wonderful. This was freedom, local control, no tyranny. Then reality arrived carrying a baseball bat. The problems appeared quickly. The government couldn't effectively collect taxes. It struggled to pay debt. States created competing trade policies, and some states taxed goods from neighboring states, and others printed questionable amounts of money. Economic confusion spread everywhere. It was less a united country and more a 13 roommates sharing a house while refusing to agree on who buys groceries. Very real world-esque kind of thing. Now came the international embarrassment. Remember all those loans from France and the other allies during the revolution? Well, those bills are due. And America's response was essentially, we have to pay you, but we don't currently possess the ability. Foreign governments were not impressed in the slightest. Meanwhile, Britain continued occupying forts in the Northwest Territory. Spain restricted American access to the Mississippi River. The new nation appeared weak because, frankly, it was. Young, scrappy, and hungry. Yeah, that was it. And then things got worse because history always finds a way to do this, though. Enter Daniel Shays, a Revolutionary War veteran, farmer, former soldier, and completely fed up. After the war, many farmers faced crushing debt. Taxes remained high, economic conditions were difficult, courts seized property when debts couldn't be paid, some farmers even faced imprisonment. People who had fought for liberty now worried about losing everything. Many felt betrayed. And in 1786, Daniel Shays helped lead an uprising in Massachusetts. Thousands of farmers protested economic conditions, courthouses were blocked, government authority was challenged, state leaders panicked, and the rebellion eventually failed. But the political impact was enormous. Wealthy Americans looked at Shays' rebellion and saw something terrifying. Chaos, disorder, instability. The possibility that government might not be strong enough to survive. George Washington was deeply concerned, and so was James Madison, and so was Alexander Hamilton. Actually, a lot of influential people suddenly became concerned because Shays' rebellion revealed a dangerous truth, that the Articles of Confederation weren't merely flawed. They might be failing completely. Something had to change, which brings us to Philadelphia. Summer of 1787. The Constitutional Convention. Officially, delegates gathered to revise the Articles of Confederation. Unofficially, many planned to throw the entire thing into a metaphorical dumpster and start over. 55 delegates arrived. And what a cast of characters they were. George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Governor Morris, Governor Morris, Roger Sherman, George Mason, and many others. Notably absent, Thomas Jefferson, because he was serving as a diplomat in France. And of course, John Adams was overseas too, which may have reduced the number of arguments by at least 10%. The delegates met inside the Pennsylvania State House. Today we call it Independence Hall. The windows remained shut through the summer, partly for privacy, partly to prevent eavesdropping. But unfortunately, Philadelphia summers are not known for their kindness. So that room got hot, humid, and increasingly full of strong opinions. This was not an ideal environment for compromise. Benjamin Franklin was 81 years old. 81. He needed assistance simply getting around, yet he remained one of the convention's most respected voices. Whenever debates became especially heated, Franklin often stepped in to calm people down. Imagine an exhausted grandfather repeatedly telling a room of fully ambitious politicians to behave. That was basically Franklin's role. Then there's James Madison. If the Constitution had a principal architect, it was Madison. He arrived unusually prepared. Months before the convention, he had studied governments throughout history. Ancient republics, modern states, political theory, everything, right? He had brushed up on everything. While everyone else packed their clothes, Madison apparently packed homework. His preparation paid off, though, because he arrived at the plan, a very ambitious plan. And that plan was about to ignite the first major fight of the convention, the Virginia Plan. And trust me, people had opinions, like big time. So Madison's proposal was bold, very bold, maybe a little too bold, depending on who you ask. The Virginia Plan called for a strong national government with three branches: legislative, executive, and judicial. Sound familiar? It should. Many of its ideas made it into the Constitution, but there was one feature that immediately caused panic among smaller states. Representation would be based on population. Larger your state's population, the more power you receive. So Virginia loved this idea. Pennsylvania loved this idea. And of course, Massachusetts liked it too. But smaller states looked at the proposal and said, no. Because from their perspective, the Virginia Plan sounded suspiciously like, congratulations, you've been invited to participate in government where Virginia gets everything it wants. States like Delaware and New Jersey feared becoming politically irrelevant. If the population determined representation, large states could dominate national policy forever. Smaller states had not fought a revolution just to become side characters in the quest. Enter William Paterson of New Jersey. Now, Paterson proposed an alternative, the New Jersey Plan. This proposal preserved a system where each state received equal representation. One state, one vote, simple. Smaller states loved it, large states hated it. And just like that, the convention had split into rival camps. 4 weeks of arguments erupted. Delegates gave speeches, counter-arguments, rebuttals, counter-rebuttals. At times, it felt like the nation, less like nation building and more like a debate tournament that had gone completely off the rails. One delegate later admitted that the convention occasionally seemed like it was on the verge of collapse. And honestly, that's not an exaggeration. At several points, delegates threatened to leave. Some openly questioned whether agreement was even possible. The entire convention nearly failed before producing anything useful. History often presents the Constitution as inevitable, but it wasn't. There were many moments when the whole project could have fallen apart. Then Roger Sherman of Connecticut stepped forward with an idea, and suddenly the temperature in the room dropped by approximately 3 degrees. Not literally, but Philadelphia was miserable. But politically, things improved. Sherman's proposal came known as the Great Compromise. The solution was elegant. Create two houses of Congress. One house, representation, would be based on population. This became the House of Representatives. And the large states got what they wanted. And on the other house, the state would, every state would receive equal representation. And that became the Senate. Small states got what they wanted. Neither side got everything, which is usually, you know, how a compromise is real. So the Great Compromise saved the convention. And without it, there may have never been a constitution. But unfortunately, solving one argument simply made room for another, because America was about to confront one of the darkest issues in history, which is slavery. Now, let's be very clear. The Constitution is one of the most important political documents ever written. That can be true, but it also can be true that many of the delegates made deeply troubling compromises. Like, both things exist at the same time. Several Northern delegates wanted enslaved people excluded from population counts. Southern delegates wanted enslaved people counted, not because they believed enslaved people deserved rights, not because they wanted voting access, not because they recognized equality. They wanted enslaved people to be counted for representation in their population. More population meant more seats in Congress. This debate became intensively controversial, and eventually the delegates reached what came known as the Three-Fifths Compromise. Now, under this arrangement, enslaved individuals could count as three-fifths of a person for purposes of representation and taxation. Like, you could totally hear my eye rolling through all of this. Even some delegates recognized the contradiction. The nation was founded on ideals of liberty, yet millions remained enslaved. The Constitution created a government dedicated to freedom while simultaneously accommodating slavery. This contradiction would haunt the United States for generations. History's burn book refuses to pretend otherwise. The delegates knew slavery was a problem. Now, many hoped future generations would solve it, and future generations eventually did, but only after a civil war that killed hundreds of thousands of people. Sometimes postponing a problem makes it larger. And the Constitutional Convention provides a textbook example. Oh, Winnie had to be in here to listen to the story, because she's very much on the Constitutional Convention. That's her jam, her favorite part of everything. So if slavery wasn't difficult enough, another fight emerged almost immediately. Like, how should the president be chosen, right? And this question produced some truly fascinating ideas. Some delegates wanted Congress to select the president. Others preferred direct election by the people. Several worried that ordinary citizens lacked sufficient information. Others worried Congress would gain too much influence. Nobody seemed entirely happy with any solution. And after weeks of debate, the delegates invented something new. The Electoral College, which at this point I think we can get rid of. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Now, before anyone listening starts preparing strongly worded emails, remember, these delegates themselves were not fully satisfied either. The Electoral College emerged because it represented a compromise. Like many constitutional compromises, it was less perfect solution, more best idea we've got before somebody storms out. Then came another question. How powerful should the president actually be? Remember, everyone remained terrified of creating another king. The revolution had happened because Americans believed one king possessed too much power. Nobody wanted King George III, the sequel, in this situation. Now, some delegates favored a weak executive. Others believed strong leadership was necessary. The resulting presidency landed somewhere in the middle of that. Powerful enough to govern, limited enough to prevent monarchy, at least in theory. Then attention turned towards the courts. A national judiciary was created, a Supreme Court established, federal judges would interpret laws, and thus began another American tradition, arguing about the Supreme Court. Some traditions just never die, right? Throughout all these debates, one figure remained quietly influential, and that is George Washington. He rarely spoke during the convention because he didn't need to. His presence alone carried enormous weight. Everyone trusted him. Well, or almost. When Washington supported an idea, people actually listened. When Washington remained silent, people wondered why. The convention benefited enormously from his reputation. In many ways, he was the glue holding everything together, and thank goodness for that, because the biggest battle was still coming. The battle over whether the Constitution should exist at all, because writing the document was only half of the challenge. Getting people to approve it would be even harder. The delegates were about to discover that convincing politicians inside one building was much easier than convincing an entire country. And waiting just beyond the convention doors were the Anti-Federalists, a group of critics who believed the Constitution might be creating exactly the kind of powerful government Americans had fought a revolution to escape. The arguments were about to become even louder, and somehow Benjamin Franklin is still trying to keep everyone civil. Poor Benjamin Franklin. Poor man. Poor, poor man. Anyway, many looked at the Constitution as a brilliant solution, but many saw it as a warning sign. To understand the coming battle, we need to meet two groups: the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. Now, if the Constitutional Convention was the writing room, these groups were about to become the review panel from hell. Now, the Federalists supported the Constitution. They believed the Articles of Confederation had failed, and they wanted a stronger national government. Not a monarchy, not a dictatorship, but a government capable of actually governing. Their most famous leaders included Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. The Anti-Federalists were not opposed to freedom. They were not villains. They were not trying to destroy the country. But in many ways, they were asking reasonable questions like, how much power is too much power? What protects ordinary citizens from government abuse? What's stopping this new government from being another version of the one we just fought a war to escape? These concerns were not irrational. Remember, many Americans had spent their entire lives distrusting centralized authority. Now, a document was asking them to trust one, and it wasn't an easy sell. One of the most outspoken Anti-Federalists was Patrick Henry. Yes, the give me liberty or give me death guy. Patrick Henry looked at the Constitution and immediately became suspicious. In fairness, Patrick Henry looked at most things and became suspicious. It was one of his defining personality traits. Henry feared the Constitution gave the federal government too much authority. Others shared his concerns, like George Mason refused to sign the Constitution. So did Elbridge Gerry. They worried individual liberties lacked adequate protection. The debate quickly spread across newspapers, taverns, churches, town meetings. Everywhere Americans gathered, arguments followed. Now imagine Thanksgiving dinner. Now imagine the entire country doing that for months. That was ratification. And that's when Alexander Hamilton decided to pick up a pen. And that's scary. This was a rarely calming development, because Alexander Hamilton was brilliant, very energetic and ambitious, and was absolutely convinced that he was right. The Constitution's supporters needed a way to persuade the public, and Hamilton had this idea: a series of essays, lots of essays, an almost unreasonable amount of essays. James Madison and John Jay and Hamilton began writing what became known as the Federalist Papers. 85 essays. 85. Most people struggle to finish a grocery list, but Hamilton helped produce 85 detailed political essays explaining why Americans should support the Constitution. Hamilton himself wrote 51 essays. He just kept writing. At this point, one begins to suspect he genuinely enjoyed his homework. The essays appeared in newspapers throughout New York, but their influence spread far beyond state borders. They explained how the Constitution would work, why separation of powers mattered, why checks and balance existed, why a stronger federal government was necessary. Even today, courts and legal scholars still cite them. Not bad for a newspaper campaign from the 1780s. Meanwhile, James Madison was quietly becoming one of the Constitution's greatest defenders. Madison argued that human nature itself required safeguards. People seek power. Governments seek power. Ambition must be checked by ambition. Solution wasn't to assume leaders would always behave. The solution was designing a system that expected people to misbehave. Honestly, that's one of the most realistic things ever written into government. The ratification battle continued state by state. Each state held its own convention. Each state debated. Each state argued. And slowly the Constitution began accumulating victories. Delaware ratified first, then Pennsylvania, then New Jersey, then Georgia, then Connecticut. Momentum grew, but the biggest prizes remained: Massachusetts, Virginia, New York. Without those states, success remained uncertain. Massachusetts nearly rejected the Constitution. The debates became so fierce, and supporters and opponents clashed repeatedly. Finally, a compromise emerged. Many delegates agreed to support ratification if amendments protecting individual rights would be added later. This proved crucial because it pointed towards the solution that would ultimately save the Constitution: the Bill of Rights. Now, here's something many people don't realize, is the Constitution originally did not include a Bill of Rights. That's right. The document we often associate with the constitutional freedoms did not initially contain explicit protections of freedom of speech, religion, press, assembly, or many other rights Americans now consider fundamental. Anti-Federalists noticed this immediately, and they were not subtle about it. Their criticism gained traction. Federalists realized they had a problem, a significant one. And James Madison eventually agreed to support amendments protecting individual liberties. This decision helped secure ratification. Sometimes politics works because someone finally decides to listen. And by 1788, the Constitution had been approved by the required 9 states. The new government would move forward. The United States officially had a constitution, a remarkable achievement. But before we celebrate too much, let's remember how close this came to a failure. The convention nearly elapsed. The states nearly rejected the document. The ratification campaign nearly unraveled. At numerous points, the Constitution's future looked very uncertain. History often appears inevitable in hindsight. Living through it feels very different. Then came one of the Constitution's most famous moments. As the delegates prepared to leave Philadelphia, Benjamin Franklin was asked what kind of government they had created. According to legend, a woman named Elizabeth Willing Powell asked him, "Well, doctor, what have you got, a republic or a monarchy?" Franklin's response became immoral: "A republic, if you can keep it." That is a remarkable answer, not because it celebrates success, but because it acknowledges responsibility. Franklin understood something very important, that the Constitution was not magic. The document alone would not guarantee freedom or justice or stability. The system would only work if future generations chose to maintain it. The Constitution created a framework, and people would determine what happened next. Franklin, by the way, we know he was 81 years old during this convention. He would die less than 3 years later. But before he left, he delivered one final speech to the delegates. Unable to stand and read it himself, he asked for another delegate to present it. The speech urged compromise, humility, cooperation. Franklin admitted there were parts of the Constitution that he himself disliked, but he supported it anyway, not because it was perfect, because perfection wasn't available. Sometimes the best solution is simply the best one people can achieve together. And honestly, that's probably the most Benjamin Franklin thing imaginable. It's practical and wise and slightly exhausted. The Bill of Rights was added in 1791. 10 amendments protecting essential freedoms, like freedom of speech, religion, the press, assembly, and right to petition. Protections for due process against unreasonable searches, the rights that remain central to American life today. And so the Constitution entered history, not as a flawless document, not a finished product, but as a framework designed to evolve over time. And of course, over time, amendments would be added, mistakes would be corrected, new debates would emerge, old arguments would return. Some controversies from 1787 still echo through modern politics. Apparently, a few national hobbies just never kind of disappear. Now, before we close, history's burn book needs to make one final observation. This Constitution was created by brilliant people, but they were still people. They disagreed constantly. They made compromises. They held contradictions. Got some things spectacularly right and some things painfully wrong. The Constitution's greatest strength may not be that it solved every problem. It's that it created a system capable of confronting problems its authors could never fully imagine. And that's a rare achievement. An incredibly difficult one. These delegates arrived in Philadelphia with a failing government. They left with a blueprint that has endured for centuries. Not because everyone agreed, it was because they found ways to move forward despite disagreement, which may be the most surprising plot twist of all of American history. So, the next time on History's Burn Book, we're going to talk about the expansion, eventually. Not right now, but the revolution was enough. But anyway, just remember, history isn't a story about perfect people. It's a story about people, and that explains a lot. I hope you've enjoyed it.